Welcome to Keeping Up. It's Clay, the Decision Rule Smith, and I'm here with...
Hello, boys and girls. It's Heverin again.
Ben Heverin in the house. So we have some extremely important articles this week. You've heard, do the ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation. These articles may challenge that.
Dyslexia might now work, Clay. CBA, is that what we're going to do? I've been waiting for this day forever.
So your confusion is finally paying off. We might be doing the CBAs instead of the ABCs. Next, we've got some important clinical decision instruments put out by the group at University of California, Davis. These are incredible decision rules that may decrease our CT use, especially in pediatric head injury. You need to listen. These are very, very important articles. And we're also going to be talking about...
It's a good CT day. Let's talk about lowering CT in trauma. Let's talk about lowering CT in head injury. Let's talk about kids and adults.
Next, are we going to be using biomarkers in pneumonia? Are we going to determine who gets antibiotics on the basis of a biomarker? Let's think about that. Now, low-dose TPA... or regular dose FDA-approved TPA for massive PE? Which one's safer? Which one's effective? And what does your pediatric patient's mom want to be called? Mom?
Don't call me mom.
We'll see about that
Stay
in the next
tuned.
Article. This is a CME offering from the Vanderbilt School of Medicine, and on your screen should be the full CME disclosure statement. You need to read this. It's both on your screen right now, and it's also on our website. Go to our website, keepingupinem.com, and click on the tab that says Get Your CME. Now, you have to register in order to do this, and those that register can log in and get all the access to your CME credit and also to all the written summaries that we have. Also on screen during the podcast, all the articles will be hyperlinked directly either to the article if it's free full text or at least to the abstract that's found in Medline. So you can also find these hyperlinks on the written summaries. So go to our website today, keepingupinem.com, and we hope you enjoy this week's podcast, This Week in Journals. The first article is by Nate Cooperman et al. For the PCARN Network, Identification of Children at Very Low Risk of Clinically Important Brain Injuries After Head Trauma, a prospective cohort study. This is in Lancet. It's EPUB ahead of print as of September the 14th, a very important study that very much awaited and expected. So the context and study question is this. A head CT requires a significant dose of ionizing radiation, and children are especially sensitive to the effects of radiation. So these authors and others have derived and validated similar clinical decision instruments in the past. But this is the largest study of its kind to address this critical issue. The question is, what kids can we safely send home using clinical criteria without doing a head CT? The results of the article. This study included over 42,000 children. Almost 34,000 were in the derivation set, and there were 8,627 in the validation set. In the validation set, about a quarter of them were less than 2 years of age. Now, they defined clinically important traumatic brain injury as death from traumatic brain injury, requirement for neurosurgery, intubation more than 24 hours, hospitalization greater than 2 nights or more associated with traumatic brain injury on CT. Now, a third of the patients had CT performed, and of these, about 5% had traumatic brain injuries seen on their CT, and they define what is clinically important traumatic brain injury on CT. In all, 376 of the over 42,000 patients, or 0.9%, had clinically important traumatic brain injury, according to the study definition. Now, here's the rule. What they did is age stratified it. So kids less than 2 years of age, if they have absence of altered mental status, a non-frontal scalp hematoma, loss of consciousness for 5 seconds or more, severe injury mechanism, palpable skull fracture, or they're not acting normally according to the parent, then these children are at extremely low risk for clinically important traumatic brain injury defined as hospitalization, neurosurgery, or a finding significant on CT. In the validation cohort of these kids, only 25 had clinically important traumatic brain injury, so kind of low numbers. And the rule performed with a sensitivity of 100%, negative predictive value of 100%, in finding all these kids with clinically important traumatic brain injury. Negative likelihood ratio, very low, 0.03. Now, in kids greater than or equal to 2 years of age, a similar decision instrument was used. Altered mental status, any loss of consciousness, vomiting, severe injury mechanism, clinical signs of a basilar skull fracture, or severe headache. And again, the performance of the rule was very good. The sensitivity was 96.8%. A little word of caution, though, the lower confidence interval here was 89%, and this was in the validation cohort. Negative predictive value, very high, 99.95, with a lower confidence interval there of 99.8. So a very high negative predictive value. Now, the limitations. Of the 30,500 patients, roughly, that were discharged, only 79% could be directly contacted. The others had various records reviewed to look for death or later intervention. And despite the size of the study overall, there were small numbers of patients that actually had clinically important traumatic brain injury, making the 95% confidence intervals a bit wide. But the problem is, this is the largest and best study to date. Clinically important traumatic brain injury is relatively rare.
So, Clay, I think there's a couple things you have to look at here. Number one, all comers, clinically significant traumatic brain injury in a child is low. Yep. We're talking 1%, maybe less than 1%. So your pretest probability on these patients as you approach them in the department is low. Secondly, using these rules, you need to commit this to memory, because selling a parent on why the science backs up that you don't need a CT scan is sometimes difficult. Let's keep going. Let's talk about other ways we can reduce some CT. Let's talk about adults right now. Blunt trauma in adults. I like this study a lot. This is a study out of Annals of Emergency Medicine. It was published online early. And we're going to keep talking prediction rules here. So this study, the previous study, and the next one, we're all doing prediction rules. So when you're listening, get prediction rules in your head. This study right now has two arms. The title of it is Clinical Prediction Rules for Identifying Adults at Very Low Risk for Intra-Abdominal Injuries After Blunt Trauma. The author is Holmes et al. And we're going to look at two things. We're going to identify first rules that could rule out any type of abdominal injury in the setting of blunt trauma. And we're also going to look for rules that will rule out, so to speak, any abdominal injury that needs to go to the OR or needs to go to interventional radiology immediately. So two sets here when you're listening. So like any prediction rule study, you've got to have two phases here. You have to have a derivation phase where you identify the variables at work, and then a validation phase where we prove that these variables have some prognostic value. So the predictor variables that were identified in this study for injuries that would require surgery, blunt trauma, you need to go to the OR. Here are these variables. Hypotension, a systolic less than 90, a GCS less than 14, okay, alterations in mental status, costal margin tenderness, and abdominal tenderness. So there's two there, not just pushing on the belly, but pushing on the costal margin as well. Hematuria, specifically greater than 25 red cells per high-powered field, and a crit less than 30. So that's step one. That's the predictor variables we've identified if we need to go to the OR. Let's think about this differently. Let's talk about predictor variables for any abdominal injury, any positive CT scan, and that's going to be GCS less than 14, okay, alterations in mental status. Again, costal margin tenderness and abdominal tenderness, a femur fracture, hematuria again, a crit less than 30, or an abnormal chest radiograph. What I think is interesting here is that things like alterations in mental status or a possible pelvis fracture weren't needed in this predictive variables. So if you look at this rule, it was 100% sensitive in identifying patients who needed to go to the OR, who needed immediate intervention, and they were 96% sensitive for identifying any belly injury at all, with a confidence interval that's good but not great, between 91 and 97%. Specificity, understandably, for a prediction rule for ruling stuff out was low. Let's talk about some limitations about this study. First of all, this is for blunt trauma only, not penetrating trauma. This is a single-centered study. There's obviously going to be inter-observable variability, and especially in how you define costal margin and abdominal tenderness. Prediction rules, we know, are never definitive. We know that they aid us in deciding what interventions, what diagnostic procedures we need to do. And the authors admit here that anybody with hypotension should probably have that used as a predictive variable for ruling out something that needs to go to the OR or something that just might define having an injury inside the belly on CT scan.
Absolutely. You know, even if it didn't statistically pan out for predicting any abdominal injury, you know, we need to throw that in there.
So here's my take home for you. This rule is really good. I don't think we're ready for prime time, but I think we need to look at this. We need to watch for it to come out in a prospective multi-center trial and see if this really works for us.
This same group did validation of a prediction rule for the identification of children with intra-abdominal injuries after receiving blunt torso trauma. This is also in Annals of Emergency Medicine. It was published on the electronic version ahead of print back in February, but we're doing it all together now. So the question again, can clinical variables obviate the need for abdominal and pelvic CT scans in pediatric trauma? Now, this was an external validation of a previously derived and internally validated clinical decision rule for intra-abdominal injury, and it consisted of the following variables. So the variables that had already been proven to be predictors were a low age-adjusted systolic blood pressure, abdominal tenderness, femur fracture, an AST greater than 200 or ALT greater than 125, hematuria greater than 5 red cells per high power field, and an initial hematocrit less than 30%. Now, if the child lacked all of these variables, the rule performed with a sensitivity of 95%, confidence intervals still a little wide, 90% to 98%, and if the rule had been followed, CT use would have been reduced by one-third. Now,
that's a powerful number.
Also, though, the problem is of those who would not have undergone CT had you not scanned them based on this rule, 8 children had injuries that would have been, quote, missed without the CT scan, and one of these did go to the OR. Now, in the OR, it was a non-therapeutic laparotomy.
And all of those 8 kids did okay.
They did. All of them did fine. And the other 7 kids really had non-operative injuries, were observed in the hospital, and had no interventions. And really, the kid that went to the OR had no intervention in the OR. He had a serosal tear and a mesenteric hematoma. Now, the limitations, this was a select population of patients already selected for diagnostic imaging, DPL, or diagnostic laparoscopy or laparotomy. So you have to say there's some selection biases that's inherent in it, but that can't be avoided ethically. The sensitivity of the rule was only 95% and the lower confidence interval 90%, so it's really too high of a miss rate at this point. So I think the way this applies to my practice is I'm thinking this rule is helpful in framing your thinking about imaging decisions in pediatric blunt torso trauma, but I don't think at this point we can embrace it as the sole means of ruling out intra-abdominal injury in children. It needs to be further refined, and it needs to be further validated again in a multi-center study. But it's getting there.
This research is hot. This will continue to grow. From a practical standpoint here, I'm an inpatient ER doc. I really like to make decisions right on the front end, and I've got to wait for lab tests to come back here before I rule out. So from an operational perspective, that might be a little bit frustrating, but it's worth it to avoid the radiation.
I think a few things to remember. If there's hypotension, they need radiation. If there's alteration, they need radiation. If there's tenderness to palpation, they need radiation. If there's blood with urination, they need radiation. And if there's exsanguination, they need radiation. So there you go.
Or they need a priest. I'm doing everything I can not to burst out laughing right now. Just the accent was impressive.
I tried to do a little Cajun thing there.
I liked it. Mike Malone, that's a shout out to you, buddy. Mike's a paramedic downstairs. He's one of our best Cajun paramedics. You'd do him proud right there.
We're going to switch gears here and talk about CPR.
All right. Remember, the American Heart Association right now says, pump hard, pump fast, pump often. It's all about being on the chest during resuscitation. So how long should I actually be doing CPR during a code? Interesting study here. The author is Christensen et al. The title is Chest Compression Fraction Determines Survival in Patients with Out-of-Hospital Ventricular Fibrillation. So before we get going, let's define chest compression fraction. So take an arrest time. Let's say you're coding somebody for 60 seconds. Let's say you're doing compressions for 45 seconds. Your chest compression fraction is 75%. Take the amount of time doing compressions divided by the total amount of time you're coding a patient. That's your chest compression fraction.
I think 100% chest compression fraction. That's what I'm going for, Ben.
That's what we're going for. I like it. Let's see. So let's talk about this study. This looked at EMS data on 504 patients with out-of-hospital VF or pulseless VT. We're going to consider VF and pulseless VT the same thing here. The algorithm's the same. We had 11 study centers within North America. 71% of the enrollees had witnessed arrests. Survival overall for VT-VF was good, 23%. So if God decides for you to arrest right now, Clay, ask God for VT or VF. PEA, not so much.
Oh, no. Don't want it. I don't want either one.
Now, interesting, the data you collect here was taken from the AEDs used by the paramedics, and they can judge how often CPR was done based on impedance readings from the AED. So quantitatively, you could determine how many seconds per minute compressions were being done. And let's do that in five quartiles, 20, 40, 60, 80, and 100%. So of every 60 seconds, 12, 24, 36, 48, and 60 seconds. And interestingly, an odds ratio here for a compression fraction between 60 and 80% of the time on mortality was 3, with a clinical significance 95%, 1.37 to 6.58. Even a 10% increase in this compression fraction had a clinically significant bump in the odds ratio of 1.11.
So what you're saying is the more time they spent compressing the chest, the better the patient did.
Yes, kind of.
Okay.
Ready for a catch?
Yeah.
If you take your compression fraction between 80 and 100%, statistically, it wasn't as good as between 60 and 80%. Now, I don't want to confuse people here. The authors say we need to investigate this more. They make a couple inferences here. Perhaps between 80 and 100%, people weren't getting the epinephrine they need. They weren't getting the analysis that they would. But that needs to be researched more. In general, I like this study. There's a couple limitations. The included population overall was low. They had 14,000 people eligible, and they only got 504 patients in. That's because those were the only patients who had VTVF, where they could quantitatively monitor the compression data. So tough when you're excluding that many patients. The other thing you need to think about is that 60 to 80 versus 80 to 100% isn't really explained further. You need more data there. The authors describe it as curious, and then they stop.
Yeah, one wonders if you're just constantly on the chest, if there's no time for chest recoil, maybe they're too much on the chest. I don't know.
Me neither.
Yeah.
I still think high-quality CPR is where it's at. It saves lives, especially in VTVF. You need to think about reversible causes for PEA and asystole. But for VTVF, get the electricity going, get the compressions rocking, minimize your off-chest time. Stay tuned for some more research here because this is a hot area of research.
So we went ahead and did the next article, which is, again, e-published ahead of print in Annals of Emergency Medicine about interruptions in cardiopulmonary resuscitation from paramedic endotracheal intubation. This is by Wang et al. It was released in July, but we're doing it with these other important CPR articles. So we all know the mantra, stay on the chest. A lot of recent studies have shown that minimally interrupted chest compressions, better patient outcomes, and just yet another article that's leaning us in that direction. But the question is, how much does endotracheal intubation contribute to interrupting chest compressions? Because we always were taught A, B, C, get the airway. Well, the results were these authors used very smart monitors that could actually measure sternal compression, again, like Ben was talking about last time, and took audio recordings of all the sounds going on at the scene. And they recorded a lot of other variables simultaneously as well. So in total, 100 patients were included in the study. The median number of chest compression interruptions for endotracheal intubations was 2. The median time of the first interruption in chest compressions was 46.5 seconds for intubation. The median total time of chest compression interruptions was 109.5 seconds. With about a quarter of those over 3 minutes.
So you're saying 2 minutes on average, I've got no compressions.
Yeah, in each code, because they're trying to get a tube.
2 minutes of anoxic brain injury time.
Not good. So the limitations, only one patient survived to hospital discharge, so pretty low survival rates in this particular population. In total, during this time of the study, 182 patients arrested and 82 were excluded, mostly because the monitor wasn't working right, or it was muted, or the sternal compression sensor wasn't working. Also, this reflects data from only 2 EMS agencies, so there may be some generalizability that's difficult. And what was actually happening on scene may not have been perfectly clear on the audio recording, though they said that often the paramedics talked themselves through each intubation, making it pretty apparent what was going on, and pause compressions, that sort of thing. Now, the application is this. As our previous article and the next articles are going to show, the best policy may be to do high-quality chest compressions and think about a definitive airway later, actually. Passive oxygen, esophageal tracheal tubes that can be inserted while doing compressions, this may be where we need to go in the future.
CBA, not ABC.
It's looking that way. And this article may really push us in that direction.
This is from the Arizona crew. Now remember, Clay, Arizona is the place where the idea of cardiocerebral resuscitation came out. saying that chest compressions only, minimal ventilations is probably a good thing for the brain. Probably doesn't matter as much how much oxygen is in the bloodstream. What really matters is how much perfusion you're giving to the brain by keeping the perfusion pressure up with compressions. So this theory came out of Arizona. We're going to continue to look at that in the out-of-hospital setting. This article is titled Passive Oxygen Insufflation is Superior to Bag Valve Mask Ventilation for Witnessed Ventricular Fibrillation Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest. The author is Bob Rao et al. Let's define passive oxygen insufflation. I feel all of my studies, I've got to define things first. This means simply putting a nasal trumpet in and putting a non-rebreather mask on a patient, even a patient who is coding comatose out and not breathing.
Yeah.
That's all you need. That doesn't make any sense, but the data does. Watch this. So let's take 1,000 adults in Arizona who were coding, and the protocol that they had going on for resuscitation is something called minimally interrupted cardiac resuscitation, which builds from that theory of cardiocerebral resuscitation. So if you're a medic, you show up on scene, boom, I'm doing 200 compressions, then let's do an analysis, let's give some epinephrine, let's do a little ACLS. Right after that, I'm going right back to another 200 compressions. How do I manage oxygenation and ventilation during those cycles of 200 compressions? Well, in this study, 459 patients received passive ventilation. Just put them on a non-rebreather and put a nasal trumpet in them. 560 patients had bag valve mask ventilation. So that's more active ventilation. Let's blow the air in.
30 to 2.
Exactly. Now let's look at this. Neurologically intact survival in both groups, not real good, 10%. But let's break that down. Let's just look at witnessed VTVF. Again, Clay, if your heart stopped beating right now and I saw you go down and you had VTVF, that's a good thing.
I want the thump.
Yes. If I didn't see you go down and you're in PEA, that's not such a good thing. 38.2% of patients in the passive ventilation cohort survived and had a neurologically favorable outcome. That's an amazing number. I can arrest and more than one out of three of my patients are going to do well. Notice in the bag valve mask cohort, only 25.8%, still a good number, but clinically significantly lower, survived with a good neurologic outcome. Unwitnessed VTVF patients had no significant changes. Now, interestingly, patients who did not have a shockable rhythm did poorly. Their survival rate was clinically insignificant between the two groups, ranging between 1% and 3%. A couple limitations here. This is a retrospective study. It only looks at out-of-hospital arrest. The study wasn't randomized. There's probably a little bias there. We don't know about ventilatory management in the later stages of the code, and we can't assess the quality of chest compressions. Interesting application, though. Again, all about getting perfusion to the heart and the brain passively when you're coding somebody in VTVF. Get the heart ticking again. Make the heart tick yourself with your compressions. Don't worry about active oxygenation. Probably the positive pressure you're giving is reducing coronary perfusion pressure, and we spend too much time worrying about ventilation as opposed to compressions and perfusing the brain with any kind of blood, even its deoxygenated blood.
Yeah, it's looking more and more like the goal is going to be get on the chest and stay on the chest, lots of compressions, and really C is taking a more active role than A, it looks like in this article.
And the only caveat I'll add, if you're not in VTVF and you had a hypoxic arrest, they need oxygen.
Yes.
So yeah. You've got to take this in the context for the study group we're looking at.
That's right. The next article is by Schutz et al. Effect of procalcitonin-based guidelines versus standard guidelines on antibiotic use in lower respiratory tract infections, the ProHosp randomized control trial in JAMA.
Hey, you want to do a clinical pearl since we're going to talk port and PSI and CRIB 65?
Do a pearl.
Ready? Pearl. So, Clay. PSI CRIB 65. What's the story there?
I just Google PSI.
That's what I do too. So people need to know we've got clinical prediction rules for pneumonias, for knowing how well our patients do. You hear those terms thrown around in residency and maybe you don't know them. So let's start with PSI. Let me tell you, I can't rattle off PSI off the top of my head. I need to Google it.
Is that pounds per square inch?
Okay, so PSI though, we're going to calculate mortality at 30 days. And the way we do this is by Googling a proven algorithm, a decision tree that works. It's going to ask, how old is the patient? Do they have comorbid disease? Do they have vital sign abnormalities? And do they have laboratory test abnormalities? Fun lab tests include acidosis, uremia. Vital sign abnormalities include tachycardia, tachypnea, hypoxia. All that gets put into a big computer and spits out a mortality. Remember, PSIs of 4 and 5 are high mortality. They better be coming to the hospital, maybe to the ICU. But let's talk CRIB 65 instead. This is a little bit easier for me to remember. C, confusion. U, uremia, BUN greater than 19. R, respiratory rate, if I'm breathing over 30 times a minute. B, blood pressure. Hypotension is bad, specifically systolic less than 90. And 65 if your age is over 65. Any score, so add those up. I've got five things I can add up. If my score is 2 or higher, those patients should probably come in. If my score gets to 4 or 5, my mortality is very high. Those are the prediction rules that we use to estimate mortality and risk stratify our patients for pneumonia, and they've been proven to work well.
So, Ben, in light of these scoring systems like Pneumonia Severity Index, PSI, CURB 65, which you can just plug and chug in any sort of online calculator, how do biomarkers compare? That's what the next two articles are going to talk about. The first one is by Schutz et al., Effective Procalcitonin-Based Guidelines versus Standard Guidelines, which is these scores, on antibiotic use in lower respiratory tract infection, the ProHOSP randomized controlled trial in JAMA, very recently. So the study question is, can a procalcitonin measurement guide antibiotic therapy in patients who have lower respiratory tract infection? Meaning if it's low, you withhold antibiotics and they do okay, or if it's above a certain threshold, you give antibiotics. This was a multi-center randomized controlled non-inferiority trial that had 1,359 patients presenting to the ED with symptoms consistent with some form of lower respiratory tract infection. They were randomized to receive antibiotics or not based on standard evidence-based guidelines, that was one group, or procalcitonin level with a cutoff of 0.25 micrograms per liter. Now, if they were less than this cutoff, antibiotics were discouraged, and if they were greater than this cutoff, they were encouraged. So there was no difference in the primary outcome of 30-day composite adverse events, death, empyema, etc. And there was a significant decrease in secondary outcome of antibiotic use and duration of antibiotic therapy in the procalcitonin group. So what I'm saying is, whether you used a biomarker, procalcitonin, or standard clinical decision instruments like the CURB 65 or Pneumonia Severity Index, these patients both did okay. Now, the limitations are this. Composite outcomes are a little tricky. There was a trend toward higher mortality in the procalcitonin group. Not statistically significant, but a trend. A lower composite outcome, though. Physicians also knew that they were being monitored, which may have produced a Hawthorne effect. And a lot of patients had pneumonia as their lower respiratory tract infection. And a lot of these, almost half, had PSI scores of 4 or 5. In these patients, I don't care what their procalcitonin level is, they ought to be started on antibiotics. So the application is this. Procalcitonin may improve our ability to tailor antibiotic therapy to those with true bacterial infections. I'm not totally ready to jump on this bandwagon, though, and I'm still going to go with the PSI, CURB 65, those kinds of scores at this point.
I do like the idea of finding a way for us to tailor antibiotic use.
Yes.
And I don't think we should be pulling triggers on procalcitonin for anybody that comes in with a little cough, little wheeze, or little fever.
Right.
But that's an interesting idea to be able to use a biomarker to limit the amount of antibiotic that I give or to prove that I definitely need to give antibiotics.
Yeah.
So stay tuned there. Let me give you my rule on biomarkers, Clay. If there are more than 10 syllables in the name of a biomarker, I don't like it.
Like
so,
mid-regional
proadrenomedullin. Say that 10 times fast. Midrenal proadrenal. I can't even do it twice. Okay. But let's talk about it. This study is by Huang et al. The title of the study is Midregional Proadrenomedullin. Go ahead, count. That's 10 syllables. So yeah, I'm biased. I don't like it. The title is Midregional Proadrenomedullin as a Prognostic Tool in Community-Acquired Pneumonia. This study just came out last week in CHEST. So the question is this. Are patients who are diagnosed with community-acquired pneumonia, do we risk stratify them well enough? Do those scores, do the PSI and CURB 65 work well enough for predicting mortality? And could this additional biomarker provide a more eloquent way of risk stratifying these patients in the emergency department? The study took 1,653 patients and enrolled them. They drew levels of, I'm just going to call it ADM. ADM levels correlated nicely with a patient's PSI score and 30-day mortality. They also outperformed procalcitonin, just barely, with an area under the curve of 0.76 versus 0.65. For those at home who are wondering about area under the curve, remember the closer that number comes to 1, the more perfect the test. The closer that number comes to 0, the more perfectly awful the test is.
Yes, good.
How's that? All right. ADM, though, did not improve the prognostic ability of the PSI, except perhaps in the sickest subset of patients, those with PSIs of 4 and 5. Lots of limitations here. This study only included adults coming to the ED, excluded patients who were already ventilated, who had comorbid diseases like alcoholism, TB, and HIV, which are some of our at-baseline highest-risk patients. I smell some conflict of interest here too, Clay. If you look at the authors, four of them received funding from the manufacturer of ADM. The manufacturer covered the total cost of this study, and there were no disclosures on the cost to ADM anywhere in this.
I'm sure it's cheap.
Yeah, I bet it's real cheap. The authors admit, here's an interesting quote, the identification of additional risk in a patient already deemed to be at high risk limits the overall clinical value of this biomarker.
Somewhat telling, isn't it?
I agree with them.
Yes.
So I don't think ADM is going to be worth your time right now. Maybe in the future, there'd be some prognostic significance for an intensivist or hospitalist at hospital day 3 or 4. Right now, stick to CRIP65, stick to PSI. The patients that are sick based on those clinically derived prediction rules earlier are going to be sick and need to come in the hospital.
That's right. I'm not going to base my antibiotic therapy or not on a biomarker yet. Now, the next study is shifting gears again to PE. This is by Wang et al. Again, this is ahead of print. The efficacy and safety of low-dose tPA for the treatment of acute pulmonary thromboembolism, a randomized multicenter controlled trial. This is done out of China. It was delayed somewhat by the SARS outbreak, interestingly enough. So the context and study question is, in patients that have massive pulmonary embolus with right ventricular dysfunction or hemodynamic instability from their PE, tPA is a therapeutic option. Now, your options are systemic thrombolytics.
IV tPA.
Intra-arterial.
IA tPA.
Right, directed right on the clot, or thrombolectomy.
Rip it out.
So the question is a lower dose of tPA going to work as well and be safer, possibly, than a full-dose tPA? Now, the FDA has approved the dose of 100 milligrams given over 2 hours for PE. A 50 milligram over 2 hour dose is what they randomized patients to. So you're either getting 50 milligrams over 2 hours or 100 milligrams over 2 hours. Who does better? Which is safer? Now, all of the patients were supposed to have baseline, 24 hour, and 14 day, get this, echo, VQ, and CT pulmonary angiogram.
That's not messing around.
That's a lot of radiation. However, only 82%, 67%, and 87% respectively ended up getting all of these studies in follow-up. So a lot of people didn't get those VQs, for example. Despite that, of those who had follow-up testing, the efficacy was the same with low or high-dose tPA. So it was low-dose non-inferior. Also, there was a trend toward decreased bleeding in the low-dose group. Not statistically significant, but a very suggestive trend, especially in smaller patients, those less than 65 kilograms, which makes sense. Now, the limitations, the sample size was relatively small, and really not all the patients had follow-up studies done, so it's hard to know. Now, the application is this. I think that it appears that a low-dose tPA regimen is equally efficacious and possibly safer than regular-dose tPA. I think we're going to need to see a little bit more data on this before the FDA is going to jump on a lower dose regimen.
All right, let's take it home. Last study here, Clay. And I think sometimes,
Mom,
in academic medicine, the simpler studies are often the most profound.
I love this study.
This
I think
is
it's hilarious.
Hey, I love it too. How often have you walked into a room and be like, is this Mom? Hi, Mom.
Are you Mom?
Well, guess what? Moms hate that.
Yeah.
And that's what we're learning here. The author here is Ammer. The title is literally, Don't Call Me Mom. How Parents Want to Be Greeted by Their Pediatrician. Came out of Clinical Pediatrics just this September. The question here is, what are the expectations on interactions, greeting, and meeting your doctor as both a patient and a parent? This is a real simple study. It looked at 100 consecutive interactions between doctors and parents at a pediatrics clinic. Now, first, let's ask the parents what are their expectations about that initial encounter. Second, let's see what really happened. Over 80% of parents wanted to shake hands with the doctor. 90% of the parents wanted to be acknowledged by their formal names, and their formal name is not Mom or Mommy. All parents wanted the doctors to introduce themselves by name, preferably last name or first and last name, not just by first name. Now, here's what happened in this clinic. 33% of the attendings didn't shake hands. 15% of the residents didn't introduce themselves at all. Less than a quarter of all doctors acknowledge the parents by their actual name. Boy, is that a discrepancy. So, of course, there's limitations. This is a very simple study out of a single pediatrics clinic. Behaviors likely vary across center, region, and specialty. My hunch, though, is, Clay, we in emergency medicine perform just as badly, if not worse, than the providers in this clinic.
Yeah, with the time pressure. You know, I think another limitation is there are vastly different cultural expectations.
I agree.
For example, some religions would not like you to shake their hand at all. And the majority of the patients in this study were African American. And so you really have to tailor this to the patients that you're seeing. But you can find out what do your patients like and do your best to meet that.
Your first impression, though, in your interaction, not only with patients and their families, is so important.
Yeah.
You earn their trust, and in doing so, you build on their ability to adhere to the recommendations that you give through that trust.
All right, let's do the bullets.
Here we go.
First of all, regarding pediatric head trauma, use these clinical decision instruments to guide your use of CT in children with closed head injuries. If they lack all the high-risk features for each specific age group, less than 2 or greater than or equal to 2, use your judgment, but consider omitting a CT in these kids, and we're going to have to commit these to memory.
All right, now blunt trauma in adults, Clay. If your patient is mentating well, looks good, doesn't have any exam findings of injury, has stable vitals, a normal urine, and a normal hematocrit, they're probably fine.
True. Next, blunt trauma in kids. There's a new clinical decision rule for blunt torso trauma in pediatric patients. It's not able to definitively rule out intra-abdominal injury yet, but I would say strongly consider CT if your patients have any of these high-risk variables. And if they lack all the high-risk variables, maybe they can be admitted and observed. Maybe you don't have to scan them. I think we need more study here.
Let's go back to some resuscitation ideas here. If you're coding a patient, especially out of the hospital, you need to be doing compressions at least 60 to 80% of the time. If you're not, survival decreases.
Next, in the pre-hospital setting, we need to spend more time compressing and less time trying to intubate. Minimize time off the chest when doing CPR. Even a, quote, good thing like endotracheal intubation may prove to be harmful if it results in long pauses in chest compressions.
C before B before A. Quick paradigm shift here. The same thing in the study, out of hospital VT and VF. For these patients, it's all about compressions and electricity. Oxygen comes second. Just put a non-rebreather on, maybe a nasal trumpet in the nose. Secure that airway later if the patient's still altered after you get a rhythm back.
C before B before A. Regarding biomarkers in lower respiratory tract infection, procalcitonin may become a part of our armamentarium in deciding which patients get antibiotics and which patients don't. I'm not ready to jump on the bandwagon quite yet.
I'll keep mine simpler. Mid-regional proadrenomedullin sucks.
Okay. Go with the CURB 65.
And that's right. Stick to the clinical prediction rules that work. We probably don't need to spend a lot of money on a test that's not going to help us make decisions.
Totally agree. When a patient has massive PE with RV dysfunction or hemodynamic instability, you might consider a low-dose tPA regimen, especially in patients that are small, less than 65 kilograms. This is not yet FDA approved, but I think this is a very important topic to watch.
And finally, we're in a service industry. When you enter a room, shake hands of your patients and their families, introduce yourself by name, and greet them by name.
Play well with others.
That's it. Thanks, Clay.
Man, thank you all for listening. And make sure we're getting ready for Boston. We're gearing up. We've got our booth. It's going to be awesome. Come by. You may win an iPod. It's the new cool iPod Nano. You can video stuff and it has a bigger screen, so you're going to want to register. Come by the booth. You might win this.
Do you like clam chowder, Clay?
Did you listen last week, Ben?
You excited for Boston clam chowder?
Dude, I have never had Boston clam chowder except for like in a can. All right. Until next week, keep on keeping up.